listening to Muslimish Freethinkers, a podcast dedicated to fostering conversations on matters of faith and disbelief.
Welcome to Muslimish first virtual conference. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are around the globe. Today, we are meeting online to speak about abolishing blasphemy laws, the roadmap. This is one of the goals of Muslimish. My name is Wissam Sharafuddin, I'm a co-founder of Muslimish. And today I will have the honor of emceeing this program. Muslimish is a 501c3 nonprofit organization whose mission is to create a safe, supportive, and open-minded environment for the exchange of thoughts and ideas among current and former Muslims, to foster a pluralistic society that respects the rights of all individuals to live according to their conscience, and to abolish blasphemy and apostasy laws across the globe. Muslimish was established in 2013 in New York City and now functions in 12 chapters in North America. If you value our mission statement, we encourage you to become a member and or support us at muslimish.org, as we rely on the generous support of our members to sustain our programs. What are blasphemy laws? And why are they wrong? We believe that blasphemy laws are wrong because they violate the human right to freedom of expression. They protect religious beliefs and practices, religious institutions and leaders from legitimate and often necessary criticism. They are intrinsically bad, subjective, inconsistent laws. There is no right way to use them. They legitimize vigilantism, mob violence, and persecution of minorities. The situation today of blasphemy laws is that almost 26% of the countries in the world do have some sort of a blasphemy laws. There are some countries that have repealed blasphemy laws, the first of which was France in 1881. That's the oldest country that repealed blasphemy law. And then more, and especially the last few years, have seen more countries join that repealing of blasphemy laws movement. Malta, Norway, Denmark, Iceland, Canada, Ireland, Greece, Australia, England and Wales, Netherlands, New Zealand, and Sweden. Nevertheless, these are the countries that have some sort of restrictions or sentences on up to death sentence for blasphemy laws. The U.S. Library of Congress said in 2017 there were 77 countries which have laws criminalizing blasphemy, defaming religion, harming religious feelings, and similar conduct. 13 countries have death penalty for blasphemy. All of them are Muslim majority countries: Afghanistan, Iran, Malaysia, Maldives, Mauritania, Nigeria, Pakistan, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Somalia, Sudan, United Arab Emirates, and Yemen. Today we want to speak about how can we continue our fight to abolish blasphemy laws, one of the obstacles in front of freedom of speech. And I will be joined by a very respected line of speakers. The first of which I'll have the pleasure to present is Ibrahim Abdullah. Ibrahim Abdullah is the Muslimish founder. He's an Egyptian-American atheist who grew up as a Muslim in Alexandria, Egypt. He moved to the United States in 2002. Ibrahim says, I was forced by overwhelming scientific information to admit the faulty nature of Islam and all religions. On the first day of Ramadan in 2008, I did not fast for the first time in my adult life, and I was no longer Muslim. End of quote. After coming out as an atheist in 2009, Ibrahim lived for 3 years as a former Muslim without having met any other ex-Muslim atheists or even knowing whether they existed. Finally, in 2011, he met another former Muslim in a New York City bar for the first time. This experience inspired him to meet other like-minded people. He sought the help of the Center for Inquiry and organized the first Muslimish meeting in New York City on May 30, 2012. Ibrahim takes pride in being one of the founding members of Muslimish who shaped the core principles and goals of the group, creating a safe environment for discussion, fostering a pluralistic society, and abolishing blasphemy laws across the globe. I present to you Ibrahim Abdullah. Ibrahim, welcome.
How are you doing, Sam?
Fine, how are you?
Good. Good to be here.
Okay, Ibrahim, take it over.
Thank you. So, yeah, the idea of having a roadmap to abolish blasphemy laws that really started before our conference last year in New York. We were supposed to have another conference this year, but you know, we can't have an in-person conference due to COVID. So we're trying to do this conference online, and hopefully, you know, we have great speakers here who have a lot of experience in that field and in trying to abolish blasphemy laws. For us, the main reason that we started the group, the main reason we started Muslimish, is to eventually reach that goal. And after 8 years of having meetings in multiple cities across the US, we have a big enough group of people now that we can say that we have a backing, that we are a group of people that are both atheist ex-Muslims or Muslims who don't agree with certain tenets of Islam, who have ideas that if they were to speak about it publicly, they would be considered atheists for all practical purposes. So we want to, I think we're after 8 years of having meetings in the US and Canada, we are now thinking like what we need to move on to the next goal for us, which is abolishing blasphemy laws. There's a lot of work that's been done by other organizations, not necessarily by Muslimish. And we really didn't, until I started deep research into this, we didn't really know what was going on, you know, or what has happened in the past. And we really felt that we need to sit down with all the other organizations, both secular organizations and Muslim organizations, to present a united front with, you know, demands to abolish blasphemy laws or try to create a roadmap for real steps to actually abolish blasphemy laws. Not patch things around, not just having meetings where in countries we are allowed to, or getting people out of Muslim countries where they're persecuted. We want to change the laws in the Muslim countries so people can speak freely there. This is a huge goal, and we wanted to have this meeting with other organizations so we can discuss how we can reach that. Learn from the steps that have been made in the past and try to present a united front that can achieve this humongous goal.
Thank you, Ibrahim. We know that this is one of the goals of Muslimish, the third goal. Tell me a little bit about the efforts that Muslimish has been doing. The first two goals that Muslimish have set to themselves, and how much they've done to accomplish them, and this third goal and the thoughts behind what steps can we take to help in the efforts to abolish blasphemy laws?
Yes. So the first two goals for us is to create a place for free discussion and foster a pluralist society. These goals, we came to them after, you know, when we first started, it was only about creating a place for free discussion. fostering a pluralist society was a goal that was added about 2 years after when we were applying to make Muslimish a nonprofit organization. And we kind of like almost have achieved these two goals in a certain way because we have a place for free discussion. We meet, we have five groups across the US and Canada, mostly concentrated on the East Coast, not much on the West Coast, which we're working towards. But we do have meetings. We have meetings in person. We have meetings online. We have happy hour meetings. We have activities. People go out together and do things. And that, and in these meetings, we practice our freedom of speech. A lot of us either grew up in Muslim countries where we didn't know how to have a discussion about such topics, or grew up in Muslim communities in the US and Canada. And most of them, not all, but most of them had restrictions about talking about these matters. So after 8 years, and I've been in almost like every meeting that we've had in New York, we've had two meetings every month minimum. After all these years, I think I personally know better now how to have a discussion. I'm not as angry anymore. I used to get really angry really fast because I felt always that my freedom of speech was repressed. And any attempt that anybody did to make me not say what I want, I took that very hard and it made me angry. And I think might be age as well, as I grow older, calm down a little bit, and being able to say what I want for a long time, that had, I think, had a therapeutic effect on me personally. And I can see that effect on other people. So creating the place for free discussion, we kind of like, I've almost got a check mark next to that. We need to grow more spaces. We need to be in every major city in the US and Canada. But we are working towards that goal. We've achieved steps towards that goal. Fostering a pluralist society, we actually were doing that again in the discussions. We have both people who believe in Islam in one way or another. They don't. Most people who are call themselves Muslims in Muslimish, they don't adhere to the strict interpretation of Islam. They have their own interpretations. They have things they don't agree with in Islam, mainly women's rights and freedom of speech issues. These are, I think, and scientific issues, logical issues that just don't make sense. But there are people who still want to call themselves Muslim. They still want to practice one or thing or another, and that's fine. And as long as they agree on the main core tenets of Muslimish, which place for free discussion, plural society, and most importantly, abolish blasphemy laws. Blasphemy laws affect Muslims more than ex-Muslims, in my opinion, because Muslims try to have a discussion, and the first thing they're faced with is like, well, this is not what it says in the Quran, or this is not what it says in Sunnah, and immediately they are like thrown out of discussion or accused of being atheists, which is something they don't want to, either agree to, or they don't feel that way. They really think they're Muslim, and they don't want to be called atheist, even if their main ideas are not Islamic ideas. And we see that a lot in Muslim countries too, because anybody who's trying to reform Islam in any way is accused of blasphemy, is accused of atheism, and they're thrown in jail. Even people who don't, disagree with Quran, even if they disagree with certain things in Sunnah, there is punishments, and they are either thrown in jail or in some countries flogged and executed. So this is a goal that I feel that we need to have a Muslim backing to achieve. It can't only be ex-Muslims. It can't only be atheists. We need Muslims who are under the gun for having ideas that don't fall within the rigid framework of Islam, because they are affected by this as well. And they are our partners in this, and we need to have a united front of both Muslims and seculars who want to achieve that goal in order to achieve it, because it's a huge goal. It's very big. We have to change laws in countries that are not democratic for the most part, and view religion as the most important ethical code for people. And in order to achieve that, we need to have both atheists and Muslims to achieve that goal.
I received a question, is there a Muslimish chapter in Egypt? And, you know, we've attempted before to do something like that. And we've started like about 40 chapters that were successful in many countries. But then we withdrew back and we closed down all the chapters or the attempt of opening chapters in the Middle East. Can you elaborate more on that, Ibrahim, and the reasons behind that?
Yes. We did try to open like meetup groups in Egypt and other Muslim countries, but we felt that we would be putting these people there in harm's way. And we didn't want to do that. I mean, we can meet freely in New York, we can say whatever we want, and we're not in any danger. So it's not really fair to put people there in harm's way. Do no harm is our main, you know, tenet. We don't want anybody to go to jail or be interrogated or even be put in difficult circumstances by their family. Because even if the government is not involved, if neighbors or friends or family members learn that someone is in a group that discusses Islam in a critical way, that could cause them danger. And we didn't want to put anybody in harm's way. And that's why we closed these groups. But there are a lot of people. I mean, there's a lot of people there who are advocating, and they're taking on major pressures. But you know, not everybody is a martyr, and most people, even in the New York group, which is I would say the most atheist of all Muslimish groups, we want to talk among ourselves about these issues, and we don't want to create a problem with friends or family. Livelihoods are at stake, and a lot of members in our groups are young kids who still depend on their parents for sustenance and livelihood.
Thank you, Ibrahim. This is the importance of talking about blasphemy laws and how they suppress speech, that not only by law, but also by social pressure, right? So that's another issue that we even face here in the U.S. Thank you. We'll come back to the discussion with you at the end. Now I'm happy to present to you Mr. Nick Little. Nick Little is the Vice President and General Counsel of the Center for Inquiry. Is the legal director. In this role, he oversees both the center's in-house legal work and its outside litigation. He graduated from the University of Oxford with an honors degree in philosophy, politics, and economics, and the University of Warwick with a master's degree in labor relations. He had an intensive public speaking history at university, winning both the Oxford University and European Parliamentary Debating Championships. After moving to the United States and working in the finance industry, Nick returned to the education and was awarded his JD with membership of the Order of the Coif from Vanderbilt University School of Law, where he also served as articles editor of the Law Review. Nick practiced as an antitrust litigator with Howery LLP in Washington, D.C., but found his practice focusing more on pro bono matters. In that capacity, he represented a Sudanese man expelled from Saudi Arabia for converting from Islam to Christianity, winning him asylum in the United States. A group of hearing-impaired patients challenging the provision of sign language interpreters in Maryland hospitals, mentally ill patients in New York fighting inadequate funding, as well as criminal and police misconduct matters. Nick joined CFI in 2013 as legal director and has worked for the recognition of secular celebrants across the country, as well as submitting amicus briefs on CFI's behalf to the Supreme Court in cases including Hobby Lobby versus Burwell, Obergefell versus Hodges, Whole Woman's Health versus Cole, Zubik versus Burwell, and Trinity Lutheran versus Pauli, as well as circuit and district court cases. He supervised CFI's Florida litigation and is currently examining multiple possibilities for further action to protect secular humanist values and skeptical pro-science positions. Nick has involved himself in multiple local situations where the separation of church and state has been threatened. He has also worked closely with Michael Dodora and CFI's Office of Public Policy on lobbying matters, as well as providing advice on asylum issues related to CFI's work with threatened bloggers in Bangladesh and across the world. Nick can speak on a variety of topics, which include his expertise list at the bottom of his page that we will include in the comments section. Nick is an accomplished public speaker and can be booked by contacting CFI Outreach Department. And with no further ado, I present to you Nick Little. Hello, Nick, and welcome to the broadcast.
Hello, Wissam. Thank you. I very much appreciate the introduction, and thank you to Ibrahim as well for setting the tone. I work for the Center for Inquiry. We're another 501c3 nonprofit. Our focus is on science, reason, and freedom of expression and humanist values. So we seek to challenge, on the one hand, pseudoscience across the country and across the world, but also to challenge the role of religion in public policy. In particular, one of the programs we run is a program called Secular Rescue, which has been helping bloggers and journalists across the world, but in particular in the Islamic world, who are suffering danger as a result of speaking out against religion. This program was started in particular after a contributor to one of our magazines, Abhijit Roy, was murdered in Bangladesh outside of a book fair. And his wife, Benita Ahmed, was attacked as well and was hospitalized and fortunately survived. And we recognize that in much of the world, the freedoms we take for granted, the freedoms to criticize religion, to speak freely, just simply aren't present. And so through Secular Rescue, we work to provide financial and legal support to people who are being threatened, whether that's relocating them out of the country to a safer place within their country, or simply providing them with funds such that they can disappear from the public eye for a while. So key to that has been the role of blasphemy laws, and it's something that the Center for Inquiry takes incredibly seriously and sees as a very significant problem. When I told friends of mine that I was doing this conference this weekend, the reaction was largely, why? What's the problem? No one has blasphemy laws anymore. There's an ignorance about it, especially in the United States on this, and in much of Western Europe. For those who did understand why we were doing it, the response was very much that this was an issue in the Islamic world. But as anyone can see, this actually goes beyond the Islamic world. On this, one of the things I want to say right at the beginning is not all blasphemy laws are equal. And it's very important. I mean, we oppose all blasphemy laws, but it's important to, when you're working out how to oppose a law, to look at the law itself. And blasphemy laws exist and have existed historically for two reasons. On the one hand, it's to protect either a specific religion or to protect religion in general. But on the other hand, it's also to protect the state, where the state is closely tied in to that religion. And you can see this, for example, in modern-day Bangladesh, where the situation where the blasphemy laws are used very often is in political matters, referring back to the Bangladeshi civil war and legal challenges to various of the actions, in particular of the military, during the Bangladeshi civil war. So when we're looking at this, it's important to realize that we're not solely looking at religious belief. There's also the impact of how religious belief can be very much tied in to the existence of the state. And there's possibly no better example of this than the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, which exists purely as a religious organization that has taken on these state functions. So as Ibrahim told us, and as Wasim told us, blasphemy laws are much more common than we think. And they also impact a lot of people in a lot of different ways. I agree fundamentally that the people who are most impacted by blasphemy laws, and so who we need to be reaching out in particular to join the battle against them, are not the atheists necessarily. The religious themselves are very much impacted by this. I've done a lot of work on church-state separation in the United States, dealing with state funding of public education, of religious education. And traditionally in the United States, the strongest opponents of state funding of religious schools was the Roman Catholic Church. Because where there was state funding of religious schools, it was in areas where there were very strong Protestant groups. And so it was Protestant schools that were being funded out of taxes paid by everybody. So the first stage, if I was putting together any roadmap on this, is to look at what the blasphemy laws are and how they developed and what purpose do they serve. These purposes of defending religion, defending a specific religion, and defending the state aren't separate. All countries that have blasphemy laws will also have various of these purposes. And they kind of develop from one purpose to another. So if we look at Ireland, which fortunately very recently abolished its blasphemy laws, Ireland's blasphemy laws started out in the definitively protect Christianity. It was written into the Irish Constitution that blasphemy against Christianity was always to be illegal. But it moved on to then protecting the notion of religion in general, and now it's moved to the point where the laws have been expunged, which is great. And this is what we're seeing in a lot of the European states that have moved away from the typical blasphemy laws. In a lot of the Islamic world, these laws exist to protect Islam, and explicitly, when they're enforced through Sharia law, are protecting Islam against criticism, and there is an Islamic government and an Islamic legal system. What has happened in Western Europe more, and in countries like Canada and Australia, is that there's been a shift away from a typical blasphemy law towards a law which protects religion in general as part of a general hate speech type legal structure. So there are laws against defaming people's beliefs in countries. Poland at the moment, for example, it abolished its blasphemy law, but it's replaced it with a law based on religious freedom, where currently a store in Poland terminated an employee because the employee was posting on social media that all homosexuals should be executed. And they terminated the employee, and the employee is now bringing a religious freedom case against his ex-employer, trying to claim that this oppresses his religious rights. And we see this in countries like England, which I believe was Rowan Atkinson, the comedian, who lodged a big fuss about this, that yes, getting rid of blasphemy laws is a great thing, but if you replace it with just this idea that you cannot criticize any religion because it's what people believe, then have you actually improved the situation? Remembering back in Britain to my university days, I remember when Salman Rushdie published his great novel, The Satanic Verses. And it caused major uproar around the world. We all saw this. And you, in Britain, there was a particular uproar in that had the book been about Christianity, it could have been called blasphemous and challenged, but the blasphemy laws did not include Islam. So there was what in my mind was a very misguided effort to expand the laws to protect Islam, whereas what they should have been doing was removing the law completely and saying that the religion shouldn't be protected. So what I want to do to lay out, and it's going to be very preliminary, obviously, and I think in questions, lots of interesting questions can be brought up, such as, can we have, as a country, any type of hate speech legislation without it devolving into being just a new form of blasphemy law? But I jotted down a few points that I wanted to make on the concept of a roadmap. And the first thing that comes up is it depends where you are. The approach in Saudi Arabia, the approach in Pakistan is going to be fundamentally different to the approach in Switzerland or the approach in the parts of the United Kingdom, Scotland and Northern Ireland that still have blasphemy laws. If you look at Scotland and Northern Ireland, these laws are never enforced. They're simply there because there are devout religious communities that would see it as an attack if they were removed. So that's going to be a fundamentally different approach to dealing with Saudi Arabia, where people are executed for blaspheming. However, the impact of this, it's still important even when laws aren't enforced. And it's important because of the chilling effect, which is something we talk about as First Amendment free speech lawyers all the time. If something is illegal, even if that law is not enforced, it's a definite message that it's behavior you should not involve yourself in because you're worried it may be enforced. It may also not be enforced by the government. But as we've seen in Bangladesh, as we've seen in Pakistan, as we've seen in Egypt, it's often enforced by mob rule that someone will be accused of blasphemy. They won't be arrested, but they will be attacked in their community. So the first question is, where are you? And that will, to a large extent, determine what you do. The second point is fundamentally related to that, and I would feel irresponsible if I didn't say this, is the key thing is to stay safe when you're opposing blasphemy laws. You need to look at, is the very act of opposing a blasphemy law considered blasphemy under that law itself, which is a terrible catch-22 position, but certainly one to be considered. And that creates an international role for those of us who do live in countries without blasphemy laws, who do live in countries with strong protections of freedom of speech, that it's up to us here to take on as much as we can of the role. And one of the absolute key things, I would say the third thing, the most important thing, is the role of education. We need public opinion on our side. We need public opinion globally, and we also need public opinion within the specific country. So we need to educate our friends. We need to use social media to educate people on what the harm that blasphemy laws do. People don't even know they still exist in many cases. Tell people they exist. Tell people how they're enforced. Tell people the harm that they do. Bring about, if it's in a country which isn't going to change on its own, like in Ireland, we managed to change this through public pressure because the public saw how ridiculous these laws are. But if you're in a country, for example, if we're looking at Saudi Arabia again, there is no internal pressure that is going to convince the Saudi government to get rid of its blasphemy laws. And so pressure there needs to be international. And we've seen this with the death penalty in Europe, that European countries are excluded from the benefits of the EU until they get rid of the death penalty. We should not be holding the World Cup in a country that has the death penalty for blasphemy. That's the kind of international pressure and isolation we need to work to bring forward. A fourth method is we need to look at, is there a benefit in shifting from the existence of a blasphemy law towards the non-enforcement of those laws? So the law stays on the books, but possibly just simply isn't enforced. But in that, you need to beware what I call the offended trap. We need to be aware that in countries such as Britain, we move from an official blasphemy law to a, well, don't offend religious people laws. It's critical that we protect minority opinions, but that is not, we do not protect minority opinions by criminalizing, criticizing them. And then finally, in my roadmap, it's keep going. This doesn't happen overnight. It has taken hundreds of years in countries for these laws to be abolished. We need to keep fighting to continue onwards. The history is on our side on this, and we're going to win. Let's just make sure we win as quickly as possible, and we don't give up when we have negative results. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. That was very insightful. One practical kind of an action item that you've put on the table, maybe directly or indirectly, when you said that we should not hold the World Cup in a country that has blasphemy laws. I think these kind of events for countries that are trying to be normalized on the and enter into the global society, this is the kind of pressures we can apply through these different, through FIFA, through different organizations.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's not, the critical thing is we're not alone there, and we need to look out, and we need to be working with women's rights groups who also should be saying the World Cup should not be in Qatar. With LGBTQ rights groups, we need to be working together with these people. We're not fighting individual battles. We shouldn't fight individual battles.
Thank you, Mr. Nick. We're going to come back for more conversation. Right now, I'll be introducing to you our third speaker, and I have the pleasure of introducing Maryam Namazi. Maryam was born in Tehran, but she left Iran with her family in 1980 after the establishment of the Islamic Republic. She then lived in India, the UK, and then settled in the United States, where she began her university studies at the age of 17. After graduating, Maryam went to the Sudan and to work with Ethiopian refugees. Halfway through her stay, an Islamic government took power. She was threatened by the government for establishing a clandestine human rights organization and had to be evacuated by her employer for her own safety. Back in the United States, Maryam worked for various refugee and human rights organizations. She established a committee for humanitarian assistance to Iranian refugees in 1991. In 1994, she went to Turkey and produced a video documentary on the situation of Iranian refugees there. Soon after her return to the United States, she was elected executive director of the International Federation of Iranian Refugees, an international organization with 60 branches in nearly 20 countries. As director of the refugee-run organization, she campaigned on behalf of thousands of Iranian asylum seekers and refugees, having intervened successfully on many cases preventing. Some successes include preventing the deportation of over 1,000 from Holland, including having spoken at a parliamentary meeting on the issue, to a successful campaign against the Turkish government to extend the period in which asylum seekers can apply for asylum. Today, Maryam is the spokesperson of One Law for All and the Council of Ex-Muslims of Britain. She hosts a weekly television program broadcast in Iran on Saturday evenings in Persian and in English called Bread and Roses. She is on the International Advisory Board of the Raif Badawi Foundation for Freedom and Euromind, a laureate of International Academy of Humanism, National Secular Society Honorary Associate, Honorary Associate of Rationalist International, Emeritus Member of the Secular Humanist League of Brazil, and a patron of Pink Triangle Trust. joint winner of the 2019 Emma Humphreys Memorial Prize, awarded the 2017 Henry H. Zumach Freedom from Religious Fundamentalism Award, 2016 International Secularism Prize from the Committee La Cité République, and was honored by the National Secular Society for her campaigning work defending free speech at universities in 2016, despite attempts at barring her by student unions or Islamic Society efforts to intimidate and cancel her talks. She was also awarded Atheist of the Year by the Kazimier Lisiczynski 2014, Journalist of the Year at the Dodds Women in Public Life Awards 2013, selected one of the top 45 women of the year by Elle Magazine Quebec 2007, one of 2006's most intriguing people by DNA, awarded the National Secular Society Secularist of the Year Award 2005, selected Iranian of the Year by the Iranian.com Readers 1997 and 1998, International Rescue Committee Medal Recipient 1988, and received the Julia B. Friedman Humanitarian Award in 1987. Very long history of defending freedom of speech and secular rights. The Islamic regime of Iran's media outlet has called Namazi immoral and corrupt and did an expose on her entitled Meet This Anti-Religion Woman. In 2019, the Islamic regime intelligence service did a TV program where Namazi was featured as anti-God. In the past few years, she organized the largest gathering of ex-Muslims in history, led a topless protest at Pride London in 2017 in defense of LGBTQ rights. She also took part in a nude protest in defense of women's rights in the Middle East and North Africa, initiated a day to stand with Bangladesh's bloggers and activists, an international day to defend Amina, and the Nude Photo Revolutionary Calendar 2012-2013, founded Iran Solidarity and helped launch the Manifesto for a Free and Secular Middle East and North Africa. She has spoken and written numerous articles on women's rights issues, free expression, Islamism, and secularism. She has co-authored several books. Maryam is an inveterate commentator and broadcaster on rights, cultural relativism, secularism, religion, political Islam, and many other related topics. Forgive me, Maryam, for reading the whole bio, and this is actually a small part of it, but we want to have the right background of this person who has spent their life fighting for freedom of speech, and now will comment on this continued fight for abolishing blasphemy laws. Welcome, Maryam. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry, I must have put everybody to sleep now. I'm not Nick Little, Vice President of Center for Inquiry, as my, the title under, perfect. Well, I just want to thank Muslimish for inviting me to speak on this really important topic. I love Muslimish. I'm really privileged to be here, to be working with you, Islam, with Ibrahim and so many others, Noura and others who've done amazing work. And I think you really have to be so proud of the work you've done over so many years. I think this is such an important topic, you know, the issue of blasphemy laws. You yourself, Islam, mentioned how there's blasphemy laws in one out of every four countries or territories in the world. There's over a dozen which punishes blasphemy with the death penalty, and those are all Islamic states. And of course, we know very clearly that this doesn't only affect ex-Muslims and atheists and free thinkers, but also religious, sexual minorities, and also anyone who basically doesn't follow the line. And I think I want to focus, though, on this very important issue which Muslimish has raised, which is this roadmap to abolition. How do we go about it? What else do we have to do? And of course, a lot of this work is being carried out, but I think one key is, of course, in the legal sphere. And Nick alluded to this in his talk. And I think that is hugely important because, as we know, the fight for justice, whether it's for gay rights or an end to segregation and Jim Crow laws in the United States or for women's suffrage, we see that very often these are battlefields these battlefields, the fight for change in the law is very key, and that's one important step in abolition. I think it's clear that abolishing laws are not necessarily it's not necessarily the same as actually having an end to discrimination and violence and so on and so forth. We know that very well with the case of George Floyd, one of many Black men in America who, despite, you know, the civil rights movement, changes in the law, still are like dead men walking and are getting killed left, right and center in the United States. So we know it's not the end all, but it is an important step because it draws a line and says what is acceptable in society and what isn't. And I think we could start in a specific country. I think those with legal expertise, I'm not one of them, would need to look at these countries which punish apostasy or blasphemy with the death penalty and have a strategy on which countries to target. There has been news that Sudan has decided to scrap its both blasphemy and apostasy laws. And I think that is a huge step forward that makes it one less country under Islamic rule that's doing that. I think a huge reason behind that is the revolution in Sudan that took place a while back, you know, with women at the forefront. That has had a positive impact on blasphemy and apostasy law issues too. And we have to use that and move forward and try to abolish it elsewhere. The other important issue, of course, is political will. And I think it is difficult to have political will of those in power to end these because they have an interest in maintaining blasphemy laws, in maintaining apostasy laws. I think it helps to maintain their supremacy, it helps to maintain their privilege, and it's a very useful tool, not only for social control, but for political, for economic, for all forms of control of the society. And I think given that, you know, we are seeing a rise of the religious right across the globe, it's clear that this interest is not there in many situations. And I think the default when we look at apostasy and blasphemy laws is that the society is religious, though that might not necessarily be the case, in the same way that the default is male in societies where and all societies where sexism, for example, is rampant, or the default is white in countries where racism is rampant. So I think given that, plus the fact that there's very little accountability in such situations. So the reality is that even good laws, and good laws usually come about not because the ruling elite have decided they want to be nice, but because it has been taken in a sense via vast social and political movements. We know very clearly that even good laws without accountability are really worthless. And I think George Floyd is another good example. I mean, I think it's important to mention this tragedy because this tragedy affects all of us in the fight for social justice and the fight against racism, as well as against other unjust laws. If you look at his lynching effectively by a policeman sitting on his neck, this policeman, for example, had many other allegations against him of killing, of beating, of torturing, and so on and so forth. And yet not once has he been disciplined. And therefore, there is this belief by those who are, representing those in power and the dominant narrative that they can get away with literally murder. And we see that even in a place like Bangladesh, where there is no blasphemy law, that the Islamists are able with impunity to murder beloved heroes, really, like Abhijit Roy and others. And the so-called secular government even turning a blind eye to this. So I think, you know, accountability is key. And I think families have a huge role to play in this demand for accountability. If you look at the mothers of Argentina, for example, if you look at, Stephen Lawrence's mother, he was a young man who was killed by racists in London. His mother, had a huge role in changing the narrative here and even, challenging institutional racism in the police here in Britain. The role families play is key. And unfortunately, we still don't have enough families, speaking up because, of course, of the risks involved, but also because they feel ashamed of the reality that their children have been charged with blasphemy, apostasy, and the need for families to step forward and to demand accountability, because accountability is so key in being able to gain justice. One of the other things I think that's very key in this fight for getting rid of blasphemy laws is, of course, public outrage. I think, you know, this is one of the key areas because, as I said before, those in power never give up their privilege and their supremacy, you know, on a golden platter. It's very often taken by force. By social and political movements. There's a huge difference between force and violence, which is intrinsic in all states, really, but specifically and more specifically so in Islamic states. And I think public outrage really has an important role to play in forcing action, in changing laws, in changing culture, and also in making unacceptable, what was acceptable possibly weeks or months even before. And I think this sort of public outrage and mobilization is something that we really need to focus on. And I think a lot of our groups are focusing on that. The effects, for example, of apostasy and blasphemy laws on the lives of people. And I think social media can be a great help to us. It has been a great help to the fascists and the racists and the neo-Nazis, Donald Trump, one of them. But I do think that it has also given us, those who have no access and those who have no power, access in a way that we've never had before. So we have to continue giving visibility to blasphemy and apostasy laws. I think one of the things that George Floyd's case showed us is that no matter how much they lie about resisting arrest and this and that, that the video footage removed their mask and their lives, and it helped to bring about that mass, the mass protest that we're seeing today. So I think, you know, it also humanizes those that have been for so long dehumanized. And I think those who are condemned with blasphemy and apostasy cases are exactly in the situation, the callousness with which they are, annihilated, eradicated, killed, tortured, as if they are not even human. And I think removing that mask is something that we have a huge responsibility to do. And as Ibrahim said completely, is that this is not something that only ex-Muslims or apostates and blasphemers can do, in the same way that all the great movements that brought about change, whether it is the civil rights movement in the United States, whether it is the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, whether it is the fight for women's suffrage, for gay rights, all of these fights included more than those who were fighting for their specific rights. And there is, I know very often we hear this term allies, people who are not part of, who are not Black or who are not ex-Muslim, they're allies. I don't like that term because I think as human beings, we are invested and we have to have ownership in struggles against blasphemy and apostasy laws, as well as in struggles against racism. I have a problem with identity politics for this very reason as well, because only real victims, and not just anyone as part of the group, the most authentic part of that group is the only one who is able to speak out about the injustice that's taking place. And I think, in a sense, this is a human issue and one that everyone needs to speak up for. And everyone has a responsibility to do it. I think when we separate identities and isolate and segregate people, then others don't see the need or the impetus and the responsibility and duty to intervene when lives are at stake. I think another issue I'd like to raise, because I've already spoken for 11 minutes, but I want to just get through my key points, is that this whole victim-based approach, you know, of course, you know, it's important for victims to speak up. But again, also, I think the very fact that someone's threatened with apostasy and blasphemy, but then goes and, for example, perpetrates racism or bigotry against migrants or Muslims, you know, they have a prerogative to do that. But what helps that larger movement for human rights, for equality, for an end to discrimination, is one that goes beyond those divisions and sees our common humanity. And I do believe in that old saying, you know, an injury to one is an injury to all. And I think that has always been the key to successful movements. You can't, for example, liberate women if half the world's population doesn't want to support it. You have to bring in men to support women's liberation. You have to bring in believers to support the rights of apostates and blasphemers. The other thing that's very key in bringing about change and an end to blasphemy and apostasy laws is, of course, direct action, protest, being in the public space, you know, and giving visibility, normalizing dissent, I think is hugely important, because it also shows that there are so many who do not agree with these laws. And the more of us who come up and speak up, the more of a snowball effect it will have, the more of an impact it will have. I think also this is the, you know, going back fundamentally to this issue being a human rights issue, the right to be free from religion, the right to be critical of religion, and to be able to, like those who are able to defend their religion, to believe in their religion, there are others who have the right not to do so. And I think this is hugely important. One of, I think, a bulwark to us making this a huge social movement is not just that we don't have enough believers supporting us, but that we have a lot of atheists, a lot of humanists, a lot of secularists who do not support our struggle against blasphemy laws. They might do so in principle, on a you know, as a matter of principle, on a basically general scale, but they will always come and you know, say, "Don't provoke. You're going too far. What did you do to get the death threats that you've received?" There's a lot of victim blaming going on, and you see that across the board in many other movements where people are fighting for their rights. What did George Floyd do? Did he resist arrest? As if that is, even if he resisted arrest, which he didn't, even if he used a fraudulent check, because we're in coronavirus era where people are starving literally. Even so, does that mean that he should be killed? If someone did actually criticize Muhammad, Islam's prophet, if someone did criticize surahs in the Quran, even so, is that something that should be a crime? Should it be punishable by death? And we hear often accusations of Islamophobia and others which try to blame those who are trying to speak their minds. And the reality is that freedom of expression is not a group right. Because I belong to the ex-Muslim community or the Muslim community doesn't mean I have to speak as the community decides. Freedom of expression, freedom of conscience, they are individual rights. And I, as an individual, will choose how I express myself. You don't like it? Go ahead and express yourself any way you want. But I will express myself in the way that I think is important and is my right to do so. I want to end here with a quote from Martin Luther King, and I think it's important for us to make those links with the civil rights movement in the United States, the Black Lives Movement in the United States. I think that our movements are intrinsically linked, and if one movement moves forward, it is a move forward for all of us. I want to end. Sorry, I'm going to turn on the light because I can't see anymore. I want to read a letter that Martin Luther King wrote, a short excerpt of it, when he was in jail in Birmingham in 1965. And I think this is something that will speak to all of those of us who are blasphemers and apostates and who've had quite enough from the moderates who are always telling us how to speak. Martin Luther King says, "First, I must confess that over the last few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in the stride towards freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I can't agree with your methods or direct action, who paternalistically feels he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives by the myth of time and who constantly advises the Negro to wait until a more convenient season. There is no convenient season. We want an end to blasphemy and apostasy laws. We will fight for it. And we demand that everyone who believes in freedom of conscience and expression to join us in this fight. Don't keep telling us how to speak. Focus your energies on apostasy and blasphemy laws. And remember that this goes beyond whether you're from a Muslim background or not. It is about the human right to freedom of conscience and freedom of expression. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Maryam. And I love how you connected the struggle of fighting against blasphemy laws with today's struggle in America against racism and police brutality, etc., systematic racism, and how the blaming of victims on the way they're protesting, regardless of the legitimacy of that criticism, is pointing energy in the wrong direction. The real struggle is fighting blasphemy laws. The real struggle is that there are thousands of people whose voices are suppressed because of these laws, and because of also social pressure. Sometimes we create these laws in our social circles. So not only governments should be blamed, also families or social structures that create these kind of laws. We've had a campaign recently called shunning is psychological torture, so using shunning as a method. The same thing applies here in the United States, that we should focus on the causes of this embedded rage and anger and the systematic violations of human rights. Thank you very much, Maryam. We'll come back to you for a further dialogue. I'm happy now to present to you Amnesty International members in Detroit, Ken and Geraldine Gruno, who I've known for a very long time. Ken and Geraldine, they have been active with Amnesty International in Detroit since 1978, when they would bring their months-old daughter to meetings in a basket. She behaved very well, Ken assured us. Ken from Dearborn Heights and Geraldine from Scotland met as volunteer teachers in Ghana, West Africa. They both retired several years ago. Ken from hospice nursing with the Henry Ford Health System and Geraldine from teaching English at Henry Ford Community College. After living in Detroit for 40 years, they live now in COVID quarantine in the city of Dearborn. Welcome, Ken and Geraldine.
Thank you so much, Wissam, for that beautiful welcome. And we're really grateful to be invited to this distinguished panel today. We were able to listen to some of the speeches that the other members have given, and it's delightful to see them now. We are really conscious of the fact that we are not frontline experts or participants in the same groups that people are, but we feel really fortunate to have viewed human rights over the years, over 40 years now, as volunteers with the lens that Amnesty International has given us. So Ken is going to begin by saying just a word or two about Amnesty International, just in case any of the audience is not so familiar with it. And then we'll go on with some suggestions.
Thanks. And I'd like to begin by saying that Geraldine and I are regarding each of you here as people working on this project to rid the world of blasphemy laws. You are what Amnesty International would call, I'm confident to say, human rights defenders. That is, people who are working for, advocating for human rights for everyone in the world on so many fronts, as you've just explained. Here's a quick retrospective of Amnesty International. And we'll take a step back from that for a moment to the era immediately after World War II ended. Picture yourself at that time, 1945, over 60 million people have died in a war, the second war of the century. And people were asking themselves, what are we ever going to do to prevent ourselves from destroying the world and ourselves? So they decided to make another attempt at founding a world forum for resolving differences, which would become the United Nations. A human rights committee was formed, led by Eleanor Roosevelt of the United States, Charles Malik of Lebanon, P.C. Chang of China, René Cassin of France, John Humphrey of Canada, and many other folks from across the world. They worked for over 2 years to form a document that would attempt to capture what is essential to human rights, the rights that belong to everyone just by virtue of living in this world. And I invite everybody that views this to have another look at those eloquent words. They're not perfect, but they certainly express a deep concern for world unity and approaching our problems together. Virtually every country in the world has signed that document, say they agree with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. However, that document does not have the power to enforce itself. It requires treaties or conventions, as they're called, to be agreed to where the countries commit to following those values in specific areas. Now, Amnesty International. On the last Sunday of May, like this one, 59 years ago, Peter Benenson, a British lawyer, began an article in a London paper which was called The Forgotten Prisoners. He began with these words: "Open your newspaper any day of the week, and you will find a report from somewhere in the world of someone being imprisoned, tortured, executed because of his opinions or belief or religion, because they are unacceptable to his government. There are several millions such people in prison," end quote. Amnesty International took its beginning from that moment, that appeal for amnesty for prisoners around the world. That is to say that the governments of the world would say, okay, we'll forgive you for this, and we'll forget about the problems you've caused, we'll let you go. Your people who have not used violence, you haven't advocated violence, you're in prison solely because of your beliefs, your religion, your ethnic background, etc. And that's what Amnesty has worked on all these years since that time. Its primary tool is a polite letter or message to a government saying, here's what we know about the person you have, and we're asking you for an improvement of the person's conditions, access to a lawyer, medical assistance, visits by the family, release. So that's how Amnesty got its start. And the request that Mr. Benenson made went virtually unanswered, but thousands and thousands of people said, this is a good idea. Why don't we get to work on this and see what we can do together on this issue? So Amnesty International's mandate, as they called it, based on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, was originally limited to opposing torture in all cases, freeing nonviolent prisoners, and advocating for prompt and fair trials for political detainees. It has since then expanded to include the abolition of the death penalty everywhere and to the entire list of 30 articles that are in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Now we'll discuss some specific suggestions for abolishing blasphemy laws. And these suggestions are derived from Amnesty International's mandate. Geraldine.
Okay. So we have three suggestions, and they echo a lot of what's already been said. That's one of the the fun parts of being last is that you can hook onto the good ideas that other people have given. But this is these are ones that we came up with because of our lens, I think, that the Amnesty International lens. One is that Amnesty International strongly recommends a human rights education curriculum from early childhood on until adulthood. Most parents who practice a religion really feel, I think, an obligation to hand down their own religion to their children. And this is probably natural, maybe praiseworthy. But when children grow older, they should be educated informally at home about the respect that they should have for religions that are different from their own. And at school, they should be taught formally about the Declaration of Human Rights, particularly the value of the separation of church and state, the right of everyone to practice any religion or no religion. That's Article 13 of the Declaration. These are topics that religious parents might find difficult. So it's good that they would be done in schools. And these lessons can be given in social studies classes and enhanced by invitations to representatives of various religions to speak to students, especially if the schools are religious schools. Even some kind of in-service learning would be useful for them. Particularly, there should be, we believe, a special focus on the rights of women and girls, on LGBTI rights within all religions. And sadly, in fact, these rights are especially, it seems, neglected or opposed by many religions, and not just Islam. This is a personal part, but we both were raised Catholic, but we really like the term Muslimish, so we're thinking that we might call ourselves Catholic-ish. We have been, you know, apart from belief systems, we've been ashamed and embarrassed by our own church leaders here in the Detroit, everywhere, but here in the Detroit area. You know, just last week, the Cardinal ordered a very brave Catholic parent support group for LGBT children to be barred from church premises. And of course, patriarchal leadership is common across many religions. So the idea of equality for women is really important. Amnesty International, if anyone is interested, has wonderful resources on its website, approved by the NCTE, which is the National Council for Teachers of English, which I was part of, and the National Council of Social Studies. These are created to help teachers, help students to take actions on behalf of individuals whose human rights or any human rights have been violated. Ken will give us another idea.
Okay, a second suggestion is in the area of research and reports, various kind of educational materials that Amnesty works on. Amnesty International is highly respected for its meticulous research, multi-sourced and often gathered information that's gathered under dangerous circumstances. We strongly recommend that these reports be used in support of reforms, as well as, of course, in demanding accountability to international commitment by those countries who signed these treaties, these conventions that we've mentioned. Information about these reports and copies can be found at amnestyusa.org. AmnestyUSA.org, that's the website, or just Google it. You can find many, many reports, comments, public announcements, and so forth made by country and by issue. Two reports that I looked at for this presentation were a 2014 report called Prosecuting Beliefs, Indonesia's Blasphemy Laws, and a 2016 report, As Good as Dead, The Impact of Blasphemy Laws in Pakistan. Each report reviewed individual cases and stated or restated concerns and recommendations based on the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights, regarding Articles 18 and 19 of the Universal Declaration. One highlight from the Pakistan report states, quote, "The terms belief and religion are to be broadly construed to include theistic, non-theistic, and atheistic beliefs, as well as the right not to profess any belief, and should not be limited to traditional religions or beliefs," end quote. These are unconditional freedoms, limited only by the need to protect public safety from time to time. It's important to note that the common use of blasphemy laws, as Nick and others have reported, is not only used by governments to intimidate people and so forth, but also sometimes by individuals and by non-state actors to make false accusations with ulterior motives, and such as related to land disputes and family quarrels, etc. I mean, this can be used for very trivial kinds of charges. So Amnesty's reports say you should check into this kind of behavior as well as to things that are more formal. Now Geraldine will speak on.
Okay, so one more recommendation, and that's the work that Amnesty probably specializes in. We work on behalf of individuals who are victims of human rights abuses, such as people who have been accused of blasphemy, and the defenders of those victims. We do it by writing letters, by using social media, by protesting, by vigiling, all the time trying to publicize the victim's plight and to try to state how religious beliefs that those who are different from those that are approved by the government are valid. We worked recently on two cases that people will probably be already familiar with. One is a Nigerian humanist, Mubarak Bala, who was accused of blasphemy in Nigeria after he wrote a post on Facebook expressing his beliefs. He was transferred very deliberately, Amnesty thinks, to Kano, which is a conservative region in northern Nigeria, where religious dissent is unpopular and where Sharia law is practiced. So his fate is not hopeful. This is the kind of paper that we use to write. I'm not good at this. There we go. We get all kinds of directions for letter writing, addresses, and even a sample letter. The other one is probably even better known, Raif Badawa from Saudi Arabia, who was sentenced to 10 years in prison, a large fine, and very publicly the 1,000 lashes. So after the first series of lashings, that was stopped. And we would like to believe that it was the publicity that Amnesty and others raised that caused that to be discontinued. Although he's still in prison, despite all the efforts that have been made, it's really sad to read the tweets that his wife puts out very regularly about his situation. Sometimes she doesn't hear from him for 2 or 3 weeks. On the other hand, flogging has been recently abolished for future offenses, but not retroactively in Saudi. So we continue to appeal for his freedom. The last case is one of a Christian woman who was imprisoned in Pakistan for 5 years, Azia Bibi, who was able to be released thanks to the work of a really brave lawyer. And he is now working on behalf of a woman who has literally taken her place in jail, another Christian. And interestingly, something that was new to me was that the blasphemy laws in Pakistan are a relic of the British occupation of India from the 18th century. So these are, old laws, and they're often filed against Christians because of their not because, so much for religious reasons, as Ken mentioned, that the sort of secondary reason is that they are looked down on socially as untouchables. So those are just three examples. Plenty more online if you're interested. So we believe that work on cases like this is effective about 50% of the time. We may not secure freedom for prisoners, but sometimes people get to see a lawyer or a doctor or their family. And sometimes cruel punishments like lashings are stalled. So Ken, okay, we'll wind it up, yeah. Yes.
Finally, we'd like to recommend an article that we just discovered last night, which appeared in a journal called the Human Rights Quarterly in 2004. And it was written by an academic from the University of Michigan, whose name is Susan Waltz, a personal friend, but also an Amnesty expert on arms transfer and human rights abuse. The article is called Universal Human Rights: The Contribution of Muslim States. So we found a very interesting background. We thank you all for your time today, and Amnesty joins you in wishing for an end to these blasphemy laws, and we have to continue to work despite the many setbacks and discouragements. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Ken and Geraldine, and it's a pleasure to see you again. Just for people who are not familiar with Amnesty's work, you write letters. They say, is it effective? Tell us, you know, one of your experiences or stories about the effect of sending letters to a certain.
Well, we could tell you the story of a woman in South Africa when it was the time of apartheid, and she was actually a church worker working with a priest, a Catholic priest, and they were both arrested and detained for some time under really bad circumstances. They were released after a lot of publicity, after a lot of letter writing. And in the old days, we used to keep carbon copies of the letters that we, do you remember carbon paper, you know, where you wrote the letter and then underneath? So we used to keep copies of those letters. And so we had a file on this case. And she was finally released, and she and the priest came on a tour of the United States to thank people. And we were invited to the, it was just a little house party, but it was really one of the nicest things was to show her the letter that we had written with her name in it, because Amnesty works not just for people who are very public and very
high profile,
but also for people who have no name at all, hardly, you know, but who are equally brave and equally, you know, committed. So she read the letter and she saw her name. She couldn't read the English, but she could see her name. So she read that and she was just so happy and grateful, you know. So that was one tiny example. There might be other. We've had some evidence of our success. Much of the time we don't have evidence. We do it in the hopes that it will be successful. And we know that 50% is a sort of rough estimate of how many letters help. So every other letter makes a difference. That's a big, for us, that makes it worthwhile.
Thank you, Ken and Geraldine. And thanks for all our speakers again.
Yes.
We have a few minutes before the end of the program. We're open to take any question from the audience and also to have an inner discussion. Before we do that, I'd like to read one more thing, which is from Muslims for Progressive Values. They could not attend our conference, but they provided this statement: blasphemy similar to apostasy is a matter of freedom of conscience, which is guaranteed and safeguarded by the language, no compulsion in religion. It's further bolstered by numerous assertions in the Quran that no soul is responsible for another, and that no individual, Muslim or otherwise, bears the authority to punish those who believe differently than they do. See, for instance, Quran chapter 2:113, chapter 3:55, chapter 7:87. So just like I think Maryam mentioned, that we need to have allies We need to have the support of Muslims in this struggle, of religious organizations. So this is one of the Muslim organizations that actually support the abolishing of blasphemy laws. The floor is open for further input by any of you.
Can I just add something? I think one of the issues is when we talk about the importance of everyone being involved, you know, a larger mass social movement against, in this instance, blasphemy laws, and of course the importance of believers in that fight. I think that's not the same as saying that we now have to be careful about what we say in order to appease believers so that they can join our movement. In the same way that we don't require believers to stop mentioning surahs of the Quran or to stop wearing the hijab if they want to defend apostasy and blasphemy laws, I think they also need to, believers need to stop demanding that we not criticize. If we can all agree that this is about fundamental freedom of conscience and expression, we don't have to like each other's views. I think that's very clear. But we do, and we don't have to respect each other's views either. I mean, I think views that are ridiculous, views that are abhorrent, like fascism or whatever, they can be ridiculed and opposed and criticized, but that's very different from disrespecting people. And, and I think we need to make that distinction and ask for support, solidarity, for people to join this movement without demanding that we stop speaking, because the whole reason we're having this discussion is that we are getting killed for what we say, and therefore, you know, telling us to be silent or to speak in a certain way actually feeds into a climate where the religious right feel completely confident to silence us, because there's so many others, good people, you know, the so-called moderates that Martin Luther King talked about, who are, you know, throwing allegations of Islamophobia and bigotry against us. And I think they're not helping either. And I find it more distressing when I hear it from people who defend the right to freedom of conscience, except when it comes to us, you know, because they feel uncomfortable with criticism of Islam.
Thank you, Mariam. I have a question for Mr. Nick Little. You've mentioned that there are some there's some unawareness of the existence of blasphemy laws, even in some Western societies. And I've came across in one of my researches even blasphemy laws in the state of Michigan here that are very strict, but they're not implemented. Right? They're not put into practice. Do you feel with the current political climate that we should fear these, that these can be actually activated or used at a certain point?
I honestly wasn't aware of laws in Michigan that would include that. The United States is, because of the federal and state structure, it has these weird anomalies that exist. Like Alabama only changed its constitution to allow interracial marriage in the last 10 years or so, I believe, and I could be completely off on the fact that it was Alabama on the date. But those laws, and there are laws that exist in various states which are no atheist can hold public office, for example. Those laws exist, but it's not just that they aren't enforced. They actually can't be enforced because they're violations of both the state and the federal constitution. Should we be worried? I think we should be more worried about other attacks that we're going to face in this than, are they suddenly going to come out and start putting people in prison in the United States for blasphemy? I don't think that's going to happen in Michigan. I don't think that's going to happen down in Georgia. What I do see happening down in Georgia is the kid in the playground who says, my parents are atheist, when asked what church they go to, and so is beaten by other kids in the school. And we need to fight about that. I don't think we should ignore these laws, and we should never ignore the possibility that American politics is shifting to the extent that these terrible things can happen. But on the other hand, we also need to look at where the immediate dangers that the people are facing. And there are dangers people are facing in this country for being atheist or for holding any particular religious belief. And we need to be fighting against those where we see them.
Thank you, Nick. We have a question. The theme of making allies to promote long-term goal keeps coming up from the speakers I listen to. What is the hardest part of bridging ideological gaps with groups that could be potential allies? Perhaps, Mariam, you want to tackle this?
Yeah, sure. Did you say me? Sorry, my internet is a bit messed up. Yeah. Well, I mean, I actually have a problem with the term ally. I think I don't see why people are allies. Is it because, for example, they're ex-Muslims, they're allies? I mean, for me, if it's a Muslim, an ex-Muslim, a humanist, an atheist, a Christian, whoever, a Jewish, who is blasphemy laws, then they are part of the anti-blasphemy law movement. And I don't think we should be dividing people into who's the authentic and rightful victim, and only I can speak about it, and everybody else is not an expert or has faced blasphemy laws. They're just allies. And I think what it does is it divides our movement, and I think we shouldn't be doing that. We, of course, you know, every movement, whether you look at the anti-apartheid movement, the civil rights movement, there was huge differences of opinion. Just if you take the civil rights movement in the United States between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and so many others in between, where there were differences in strategy and tactics and so on. However, I think when you are creating a mass movement, it is, despite any ideological differences, despite our differences in so-called backgrounds and so-called identities, that we have commons. And I think that, you know, that's where we need to be, that's where we can build this movement. And that's why we can include believers and non-believers who agree that blasphemies are inhuman, they are, not worthy of citizens of the 21st century. And so for me, I think, it's not so much about making allies, it's about creating that movement. And also, I think the problem with the term allies, as I mentioned, is that it does then give people the sense that this is not their movement. And we're not going to win if a lot of people don't think that ending blasphemy laws is their movement, in the same way that those who are part of Black Lives Matters have to know that we are also part of that movement. You know what I mean? If you're just allies, you kind of cry a little bit for George Floyd, and then you feel a little upset and you shout at your TV, and then you go about business as usual. And I think, you know, we need to build this movement where we are invested in changing this. And I think one of the ways is to say, look, blasphemy laws doesn't only affect us psycho-atheists that make fun of religion and mock religion and ridicule religion. A lot of religious minorities, sexual minorities, women, anyone who doesn't obey the dominant narrative, because it is not as much about religion as it is about power and control and maintaining supremacy and privilege. And so I think, you know, it's a challenge to power, and that's why we need all of us, because they are very powerful, but in numbers and in a mission we are many more if we can break through, you know, these divisions of identity politics and dividing people into allies and not.
Thank you, Mariam. We will take final comments before we conclude, because we run out of time. Brahim.
Thank you, everyone. This is actually really great. I wanted to a couple of things. One is, like, when we're talking about working with Muslim groups, the only group we've worked in with Muslimish is Progressive Muslim Group. We had a conference with them in Boston at MIT last year. It was hosted by Secular Society at MIT, and that ended up, you know, being, instead of like talking about the common goals, the common objectives that we can achieve together, it ended up being talking about our differences. And I think that was because I think that is one of the biggest challenges, is that whenever we work with Muslim groups, they want to assert the fact that they are very Muslim, because they are always attacked by the religious right, by the real extreme groups that they are atheists. So when they sit next to, you know, us on a panel, they want to assert the fact that they are very Muslim and everything they believe is in Islam, and that's fine. And I think we kind of need that. We are not going to censor ourselves, because that's why we started our movement in the first place. We just, I think, have to be selective in the topics of discussion. If we can go in with definitive topics about abolishing blasphemy laws, and this is what we're going to talk about because this is what unites us, I think it will be very effective, because there's also the practical side of this. If we want to achieve this goal, if we want to actually like going to get these blasphemy laws removed, we're going to have to deal with governments that have to explain this to a religious majority. And they have to have an excuse. They're going to have to like have a way out of this. And we can't make it more difficult for them. We want to get this done. So we have to like allow them to have their religious excuse, even though there are other things that are exactly the opposite. If they want to use these couple of verses that you say they're compulsory in religion, great. Let's use it. I mean, I want to, as long as we achieve the goal, I think that's fine. And we have to, I think that's answering the question about what is the hardest thing in working with so-called allies, which I'm not going to use that term.
Can I just say two or three things about this? I mean, one of the things is that I think that, you know, it's not accurate from my perspective to say that there's a religious majority, because I think that very often, because, you know, there is a dominant Sharia law and a religious right in power, that it gives the impression that they are speaking on behalf of a majority. And I'm not sure if that's the case. And I think very often we do see, if you look at revolutions, for example, or uprisings in the Middle East, in North Africa, very much so, they are not religious uprisings and revolutions. They are very secular. They are very modern. They are very progressive. And I think that, you know, we need to take into account that just as Trump doesn't represent all Americans, And that religious right in that country. And we're seeing another faith of America, though, you know, everyone's always fed Trump and the white power type of people, that there are many different countries in every society, including those we come from or, you know, that are Muslim majority. That's one. The other thing I want to say is, I do want to challenge Muslims, because I think that, at least from my perspective, every time there has been a reach out to Muslims, it has been from us, not from them. It has always been from us. And we are always bending over backwards to include Muslims. They refuse to come to many of our events. At Gay Pride, for example, they accuse us of Islamophobia, whilst we defend both Muslim and ex-Muslim LGBT. They will never defend ex-Muslim LGBT. So my thing to the Muslim moderates is the same thing that Martin Luther King said to the white moderates, which is that, you know, I am more frustrated with you than I am with the Islamists, because I know where I stand with the Islamists. But when you are constantly making excuses for our expense over our dead bodies. And I think that it's time. And that's what I mean about building a movement. You also have a responsibility in this movement, not just us, you know, because there are also Muslim critics, Muslim reformers who are dying under blasphemy laws, because there are Christian and other minorities, sexual minorities, women who are dying under these laws. And you have just as much a responsibility as I do. And I will raise my hand to you and stand with you always. But how many times have you stood with me? Honestly, there's not that many times. There are not that many times. And I think, you know, they need to start asking themselves very, very strong questions about why they haven't taken part and where their responsibility lies in these apostasy and blasphemy laws. Their silence is killing us.
Thank you, Mariam. In recapping, and I'll give also a final word for Mr. Nick and Ken and Geraldine. when we talked, me and Brahim, about creating the next conference, and we talked about with the other members too about this conference on abolishing blasphemy laws, we started actually communicating I actually had a conversation with Nick in a previous event about this, and we and Brahim had conversations with different organizations about, you know, what can we do practically to really work on this goal and help, you know, like attack the source of a lot of the repression that happens in the Middle East due to these laws, because sometimes they're used as an excuse and a blanket to silence a lot of people with different levels of criticism. So to make this, we wanted this to be, that's why we titled it The Roadmap, Abolishing Blasphemy, The Roadmap. What can we do? And there were very, very much practical methods that were laid out today that we want to mobilize to. We talked about, and please help me if you want to add more if I forgot any. We talked about starting from families. We talked about the power of the families, the mothers. Maryam, she put the spotlight that when a person is suppressed or is jailed or detained, his family, especially his mother, his father, his siblings, they can they can actually take that momentum and create a movement to fight for this injustice for all and together. So we also talked about joining organizations that continually fight for the freedom of expression and against political imprisonment, like Amnesty International, who were very organized in sending letters, and they have action plans, and they have great programs for high school clubs, for different levels of involvement, whether it's technological or by writing, and they have members all over the world. And that's one easy organization to join and to get to work right away. From your first meeting, I guarantee you're going to be writing letters. I've experienced it myself. So we also talked about supporting organizations that are taking the legal fight, like Center for Inquiry. Mr. Nick Little, he has stood in front of many courts to fight blasphemy laws. And we've talked also about protesting. We talked about normalizing dissent. Sometimes being, you know, you can keep your personal beliefs or opinions to yourself, but sometimes also stating them and being bold with your convictions is not only practicing your right of freedom of expression, but you're actually helping others by normalizing these different, expressions, by emboldening others who are afraid of expressing the same opinion. So freedom of expression in that sense can help. I'm not going to talk more than that. I'll leave final words. We'll start with Mr. Nick.
Obviously, everybody who is listening, thank you for turning out. Thank you for this. It's a shame we couldn't do this in person. This is a long battle. This isn't something that's going to be solved overnight. It's not something that in the past has been. It's a fight that we need to keep continuing. We need to win the fight in public opinion, and we need to not get disappointed when we have setbacks. So I'll keep on doing what I'm going to do, and it's educate your friends, educate your family, educate people around the world about what blasphemy laws are and how they hurt people.
Thank you. Ken and Geraldine?
Yeah. Folks, when I was back in my 30s many years ago, yeah, at the beginning of this, I talked to a guy who was about my age at that time, and I asked him about Amnesty's work and how it had been for him over the years. He said, well, you know, our business as Amnesty people is really to work ourselves out of a job, and so that we won't be needed anymore. And so I thought, oh, that's a wonderful idea. Let's hope that by the time I get to be his age, if I make that age, I'll be able to say we are out of a job. Well, we ain't out of a job. And as Nick has said, it looks like it's going to go on and on. We've got to be prepared for handing it over to the next generation and working in solidarity with them. I'm so happy to be working. We're so happy to be working with you today on this issue. and to find ourselves as part of this huge network of concerned individuals who are interested in making life better for everybody and everything on the planet. I mean, it's a, in a sense, this crisis is helping to call us together. I'm not saying it's a good thing, it's a horrible thing, but it's bringing to light, it's kind of eroding away some of the things that have, might be standing in our way of really making some difference, but it will have to be for the long haul. I want to thank you all for your inspiration today.
Very inspiring. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you all. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you,
Georgie. Yeah. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure hearing the other speakers. Thank you to the wonderful Muslimish, Ibrahim and Wissam. It's always great to be with you guys and to be part of your important work. I do want to just end by saying, I suppose, you know, one of the things that we often face is that, you know, we're told that we're disrespectful or that we're insulting religious sensibilities and, you know, that there are some things that are sacred and taboo and that we shouldn't be speaking about those issues. But I mean, I think, you know, what's very clear is that what is sacred to one person is not sacred to another. I might be offended by a lot of religious tenets. I am offended by a lot of religious tenets. I come from Iran, and when I pass a mosque, I do feel physically ill. But it doesn't mean that I have to demand mosques being shut down. Of course they shouldn't be shut down. People have a right to their religion. And I would like Muslims to also, you know, look at this from this perspective. You might not like what I say. You don't have to respect what I say. You can argue with me till we go blue in the face. But what I do expect from you is that you respect my right to think as I want and to live as I want in the same way that I respect your right to do that, as long as we're not harming anyone. And I think that is really key. And until believers join us and take responsibility, the silent, the decent majority of Muslims who, like my parents, like many of our families, who would never harm even a fly, you know, they have a responsibility to speak up in our defense, and not just in our defense, in their own defense, because this is about, you know, that fundamental fight. An injury to one is an injury to all. It's a fight for our common humanity. And, you know, freedom of expression, freedom of conscience, these are cornerstones of rights across the globe. And they have a responsibility to stand with us. This is their fight, too. And I am waiting for them to join us in the way that we deserve and that they should.
Thank you, Maryam. Brahim, we started with you. We'll end with you. Final word from Muslimish.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. I really, really appreciate everyone attending and you know, having this great input. It's final thought is that I think we should keep this work going. We need to keep the collaboration going. We need to invite more groups to join us and coordinate our work together. We're all doing different things. And I know, Maryam, you organized the ex-Muslim group coordination. I think you really, like, I give you the credit for helping us start here, Muslimish. And you have connections with every single ex-Muslim group in the world, and you have that coordination going. I would really like to keep the coordination going with other groups that are secular groups or secular Muslim groups, secular to an extent, as long as they agree to our goal, as long as they agree to our goal of ending blasphemy laws. That, in my mind, makes them, I don't want to use the word intelligent, but like they're just somebody we can work with. We need, I think, also to like have some sort of lobbying arm that would work with the U.S. government, maybe U.S. Congress and European Parliament. I know there are efforts that are being done at the U.N. Personally, I'm not a big fan of the U.N., but I just, like, I don't think they can achieve anything. I feel that if we want to get something achieved, we need to go to U.S. government if we wanted to actually like get some. And I agree with what Nick said earlier. We're going to win this. This is going to happen. We're on the right side of history. We're going to, blasphemy laws will end. We just want to end them sooner rather than later. And I think we need to focus more on where the real problem is, which is in Muslim countries. That's where there is, you know, the real problem, and, you know, and maybe we approach this by starting with blasphemy laws in Michigan, because that's something that we can actually change probably easily. And it could be part of the roadmap. I just feel that we need to continue this effort, and it shouldn't be just like, you know, this one meeting. We need to keep this going. We need to collaborate. We need to inform each other of the efforts and invite more organizations to work with us to achieve that goal. Because it's because once we remove that sword from above people's necks, I think we're going to have a real tsunami of atheism. I was in Egypt in during the revolution in Tahrir Square, and I was there before Mubarak left. And before Mubarak left, there was a lot of opinions. There were like people who are secular, people who are Muslim Brotherhood, people who are nationalists. There were different ideas. Everybody was speaking about all these ideas. Once the revolution kind of succeeded in removing Mubarak, the Muslim Brotherhood took over. And maybe that's something that, you know, I feel that there is a Muslim majority. I feel that if you put anything to elections, the Brotherhood type will win. That's what I've seen, is that every time you put it to the ballot box, you put it to elections, you're going to get the Brotherhood. And the Brotherhood, in my opinion, is a terrorist organization. And it's not recognized as a terrorist organization in the US. And maybe that's something we need to work on as well. We need to, I feel, be practical in order to achieve our goal. If we're going to have to work with, secular dictator in order to remove blasphemy laws, that's something that we need to agree on. Like, we need to do no harm. I think doing no harm is very important. But you know, democracy in the Middle East, I think, would produce Muslim Brotherhood type results. In at least that's what I've seen in my home country that I grew up in, of Egypt. Sorry if I took too long. And I feel like I'm starting a new...
Exactly.
Can we get another round of comments, Hussein, please? Right.
But I mean, the important thing, Ibrahim, that what you said is this needs to continue, and the conversation needs to continue. As long as we're all working on defending freedom of expression by fighting blasphemy laws. Thank you all for being with us today. We went over time, and thank you for our audience. And we hope to see you in upcoming meetings. Continue the great work. Thank you very much for a very valuable time and for everything that you do. Good night.
Thank you for listening to Muslimish Freethinkers. Do let us know what you think of this episode at facebook.com/Muslimish. Don't forget to visit us at muslimish.org.